listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with best-selling novelist Robin Cook. Doctor and author Robin Cook is the writer of 32 books and is credited with popularizing the medical thriller with his wildly successful first novel, Coma. His works include Outbreak, Mind Bend, Mutation, Harmful Intent, Vital Signs, Blind Sight, Terminal, Fatal Cure, Acceptable Risk, Contagion, Chromosome 6, Toxin, Vector, Shock, Seizure, Marker, Crisis, Critical, Foreign Body, and Intervention. His latest is Nano. In each of his novels, Robin Cook strives to elucidate various medical and biotech ethical issues. Dr. Cook says he chose to write thrillers as a way to use entertainment as a method of exposing the public to public policy conundrums such as genetic engineering, medical economics, in vitro fertilization, and more. Robin Cook was born on May 4th, 1940, in Brooklyn, New York, and spent his early years in Woodside, Queens, before moving to Leonia, New Jersey. After graduating as valedictorian of his high school class, his interests switched from archaeology to medicine when he realized, as he humorously puts it, all the major buried cities had been discovered. Putting himself through college, he graduated from Wesleyan University, summa cum laude, with a major in chemistry and a distinction in government. He then attended Columbia University Medical School and spent his medical school summer electives setting up a blood gas lab for the Jacques Cousteau Oceanographic Institute in Monaco. Following residency training in general surgery, Dr. Cook was then drafted into the Navy and spent a tour of duty in the South Pacific on the submarine, the USS Kamehameha, before being transferred to the Deep Submarine Systems Project. After his completion of military service, he was discharged from the Navy as a lieutenant commander. He then undertook a second residency in ophthalmology at Harvard. After completion of his second residency, he opened a small private practice of medicine and matriculated at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government in Public Policy. He also accepted a clinical position at Harvard Medical School to teach residents and to see patients at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary. His works have been made into numerous theatrical movies, television movies, and miniseries, including the successful 1978 feature film, Coma. He divides his time between New Hampshire and Florida. His latest book, Nano, published by Putnam, concerns nanotechnology, the design of functional systems at the molecular scale. A nanometer measures 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, and in the preface of the book, Cook writes, "If a marble were to represent a nanometer, then the entire Earth would represent a meter." So that gives you some idea of the scale of it. When I spoke to Robin Cook last week, we started by rather spontaneously discussing the ending of his new book, and I decided to keep it in the interview because we don't give anything really important away, but it was an interesting conversation about endings and about editorial advice, so we start there.
You probably noticed that it has sort of an interesting ending.
Yes, it does.
This is an ending that my editors and publishers have always sort of advised me not to do, but I finally said, you know, I just want to do it.
Yeah, so have you always been able to do the ending you wanted to do?
You know, technically, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the kind of person, I'm the kind of person who recognizes that there are lots of people out there that know better than I in certain things. And so, you know, it's sort of a give and take.
Yeah.
I recognize that when I send in my manuscript, they have some responses, and a lot of times I'll take it, and sometimes I don't.
Right.
And, you know, but I give it full thought, and I also run it by my wife.
Oh, wonderful!
She's a critic, a tough critic, and I recognize it. But she has always seems to have a good attitude about things, and I can bounce it off her, and you know, you're as a writer, you're always a little protective.
Yep.
And your first response is, oh, no, I was right. You know, what are they talking about? This is ridiculous. But then, you know, you have to think about it for a little while. And so it's a give and take. And about half the stuff I do, and the other half I don't. And but it's been over the years, I've noticed that they really do, editors and publishers, like it sort of tied up and neat. And whereas I remember with Coma, my first book,
right.
You didn't know whether Susan Wheeler made it or not.
Yeah.
And that didn't cause some huge backlash so that people wouldn't read my next book. So I want, you know, so I said to myself, I'm going to do it on this one.
I think it's great to get to this point in your career and still be so open to editorial advice, because I think that's probably something that you could, in fact, decide that you were not going to worry about what they think. But I think it's great that you are open and yeah. considerate. And
it's a mistake not to be, because, you know, they are professionals after all.
Sure.
And but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily right always. So, you know, it's a combination.
I wanted to ask you what sparked your interest in nanotechnology, which is, of course, the subject matter of the book.
Okay. As a physician, and a physician who longs for and the image of medicine that I had before I became a doctor.
Yeah.
And still loves the idea of being a doctor. And I'm always aware of what's coming, or in both positive and negative sort of feeling. Technology has been a driving force in medicine, and it's been increasing over the years, and nanotechnology is just another unbelievable technology that's going to come over and take over medicine by storm, I believe.
Yeah.
In fact, the analogy I use is a tidal wave.
Yeah.
In fact, nanotechnology, if you combine it with three other things, and that is informational technology and synthetic biology, it's that triumvirate that's going to make medicine, in a certain sense, unrecognizable within the next, you know, not very many years. It's not like we're talking about science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as one of the major pillars, I realized that since it's coming, and yet at the same time, I've always been a little bit aware over these last number of years that it's so successful so quickly in terms of being in so many products already, and these companies who are making lots and lots of money from it.
Mm-hmm.
So they have all this money, and they're investing it in research and development, and it's kind of a little Wild West kind of circumstance with lots of secrecy, which is the opposite of the way science should be done.
Right.
You know, science should be done in an open forum so people know what other people are doing. But instead, it's being done behind closed doors. It's very competitive. It's very valuable. It's producing profits, sort of all the wrong things. In terms of looking at it from the point of view of safety, both in terms of health and the environment,
mm-hmm.
that's been kind of it's been kind of pushed off to the side, and even the government, the United States government, who has been behind nanotechnology, recognizing its importance, to the tune of so far about $18 billion, the government has actually shoveled out to nanotechnology industry through its nanotechnology initiative. Less than 3% of that has been designated for safety studies. And there's, as far as I know, there's no real follow-up of whether that money has actually been used for what it was supposed to be in the first place.
Right, right.
So there really hasn't been much of coordinated kind of studies of nanotechnology. And why this is particularly bad is because of the whole reason nanotechnology works. When you take a substance and you put it in a nano form, that is, bulk form is a block of whatever,
mm-hmm.
and nano form is you break it down into either individual atoms or sheets of atoms or a little construct of atoms, what happens then is that all these electrons that are part of the substance are more available. There's much more surface area in nano form than there is in bulk form.
Okay.
And what that means is that since all these electrons now are exposed, they're all available for what we call bonding. And so nanoparticles are very reactive. Even though, say, like gold, you know, you have a gold bar, it just sits there. It doesn't do anything for years, centuries. If you put gold in a nano form, it's extremely reactive. In fact, it's a catalyst. It actually causes chemical reactions to occur. And if you put it into a biological system, it'll get coated with proteins instantaneously. It just absorbs them all.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in a biological system, that means you know it's going to cause effects.
Right.
It's going to cause all sorts of effects. It'll stimulate the immune system. It'll do all sorts of things. Plus, the particles are so small that they can go every place. And some of them, you know, are even, not only do they penetrate cell membranes, go inside cells, but they go inside intracellular structures, like they go into the nucleus.
Yeah.
So here we're producing all these nanoparticles, and we have no idea really what the effect is going to be, and very little coordinated study is going on.
Now, part of what the book deals with is nanotechnology research oversight or lack of oversight. And
exactly.
So I'm wondering, what's the real story there? I mean, you were just sort of mentioning that there's been all this money poured into it, but there's not a lot of, I don't know, is that the oversight, or are you talking more about the dangers other than the money? Like, are we watching
the
dangers?
No, the dangers in terms of its environmental and health impact.
Right.
Another characteristic, a lot of nanostructures, particularly carbon nanostructures, are their durability.
Mm-hmm.
In that it takes an enormous amount of pressure and energy. In fact, in one place I read that to create some of these carbon nanoforms, they have to reproduce the circumstances or conditions inside a giant red star.
Okay.
You know, we're talking about a nuclear phenomena to have the power and temperature, heat, and pressure to create these little particles. But once they're formed, you can't deform them.
Right.
I mean, you know, carbon can make diamond. Well, these things are much, much stronger than diamond, but they're really tiny. Now, what if it determined down the line that, for instance, one of these carbon forms is called a nanotube. And if you get a whole bunch of nanotubes together and you look at it under a scanning electron microscope, it looks surprisingly like the structure of asbestos. And we know that asbestos is one of those mistakes. In other words, that they put it out on the market. It seemed to be a fabulous product. It was, you know, insulation. I remember our summer cottage had asbestos siding. It was all over the place. And I mean, much, much later, when suddenly people like Steve McQueen comes down with mesothelioma and find out that it was because he worked on shipbuilding as a youngster.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, mesothelioma. And still to this day, you know, about 1,000 people a year die from mesothelioma, from asbestos exposure that they've gotten, you know, years and years ago. But that just, so anyway, it looks like it under electron microscope. Is that enough so that carbon nanotubes down the road are going to find out that it will cause mesothelioma? Because, you know, nobody knows.
Now, when you did your research, did you talk to people on both sides of this? Did you talk to people who are big proponents of nanotechnology as well as the people that are concerned about it?
Yeah. Because it's mostly toxicologists who are mm-hmm. concerned about it. The people that I talked to in the industry itself were more entrepreneurial types who see it as this gold mine and are very, very interested in establishing nanotechnology companies and whatnot, and trying to get on the bandwagon of this research and development in hopes of cornering some patents.
Right. So that's more like Berman, your character.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You realize that it was proposed about a year or two ago that they believe that nanotechnology is going to be at $2.4 trillion to the global economy in 2 years, 2015. $2.4 trillion.
Trillion, wow.
So, you know, since it's so successful, and nobody wants to stop and say, all right, maybe we should test this stuff, because if they know that the company down the road is not going to do that.
Right.
And so the FDA, everybody thinks, has this unfortunate feeling that the FDA exists, and so it's going to make sure that the things that the FDA is supposed to be looking at, either for pre-market or post-market, whatever, that are safe. Well, the FDA is doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They say, and they rely on manufacturers to do the safety testing. The FDA doesn't do the safety testing itself. It has some facilities, but it doesn't have the funds.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a bill that was introduced by a senator from the South. I think it was in Arkansas, because I think that's where the FDA facility is. He introduced a bill to appropriate money for the FDA to actually do their own nanotechnology testing. That bill languishes in committee. It's been there. It was in 2011. It's still in committee. It hasn't been voted out of committee. And I don't think it's going to get voted out of committee, because this industry is so successful. It's got so much money. It's got as many lobbyists as the pharmaceutical industry or the healthcare industry.
Does it really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're calling up people and telling them not to, you know, you don't need, this is fantastic, you know, and they'll find someone who quotes, you know, some high official in the American Cancer Society or something like that said, oh, nanotechnology, the particles that are going to carry oncology or cancer treating drugs are so much less toxic than the drugs themselves. I mean, you know, comments like that they can then give to their
right. Very sales oriented comments.
Yeah, I mean, because it is true, because cancer drugs are extremely toxic. That's why they work.
Yeah.
And so just to say they're more toxic than the particles that are carrying them, well, that's not saying anything at all, because you're assuming that the particles that they carry them aren't toxic at all, instead of just being less toxic then. So there's lots of different ways to kind of pull the wool over people's eyes, particularly congressmen who don't have any scientific background and also are getting lots of money from lobbyists.
Yes, yeah. Nano, the book, involves characters about whom you've written before, Pia Grazdani and George Wilson. So I'm wondering, how difficult do you find it to catch up readers who might not have read a previous book that has some impact on the next book?
I keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And I just think that if someone has read the previous book, I want it to be richer, but not, you know, necessary.
Right.
And that's pretty easy to do.
Okay.
And I was very conscious of that.
Yeah.
And because, you know, there's a few references to death benefit in Nano.
Yes.
But if you didn't read the book, it wouldn't really impact the story.
Yeah, you could totally follow this one.
Exactly.
Now,
but if you had, you know, it made it even more interesting, because you see that her problem of an adult, her personality disorder, which is an adult attachment disorder, is still there.
Yeah.
And it was in the first book, and now it's still there. And it becomes a little bit ameliorated by the fact that she actually finds someone who she can relate to on some level, and that's the emergency room physician.
Paul, yeah. Now, do you always know when you finish a book if you are finished with the characters that were in that book?
Not always. Like Jack and Laurie, for instance. Laurie, I mean, when her first book was Blindsight,
right?
I didn't realize that she was going to be in 12 books or how many. I had no idea, but, you know, she was an interesting character, and I liked the fact that I found that forensic pathology was great for the kind of books that I tend to write, in that there's something that's going on that people should know about, and who knows better than the pathologists?
Right.
They get to see the final thing and try to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, but with Pia, I spent a lot of time on her before I wrote a 65-page character study of Pia Grazdani before I started writing Death Benefit.
And she's a really interesting character because she's beautiful, and then she has this personality disorder, which makes it hard for her to relate to people who are attracted to her.
Even readers, it's hard for some readers to relate to her.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a challenge. But, you know, to me, when you write a mystery thriller, the challenge is to make it believable.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that to make somebody so that it's just not the same person that lives next door to you is important.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that then that can makes it more believable, because you think, oh, Beth next door, she wouldn't do this, you know.
Right.
She'd go to the police right away, you know. so to create that, it takes a certain amount of effort and interest. But it's also because in my books, as a physician who is interested in all the different specialties, I mean, I found psychiatry very interesting, although I knew I never wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Uh-huh.
And I've read probably more in psychiatry than most. I know I read more than most other surgeons. I went through a surgical residency, and I was, you know, surgeons really look down their noses at psychiatrists and vice versa.
Surgeons are very opinionated about, I think, all specialties, aren't they?
Exactly. Particularly psychiatrists.
Okay.
And, you know, because they're the ultimate, you know, extreme where, you know, you get in there and you do something, for goodness sake. You don't just sit there. And,
right, you fix it.
You know, get in and fix it. So I did have the benefit of having that kind of interest, and then the benefit in my medical training of being trained in so many different subspecialties, because I did a general surgical residency first. So I really have I had the benefit of really seeing medicine in from many different angles.
Yeah, yeah. And what of all your novels, what would you say has been the most challenging book to write, science or medicine-wise, for you?
You know, that each one is a challenge, I have to say.
But, okay.
Each one, and so often, when I decided I wanted to write the first book with Lori, I realized that my forensic pathology background was so bad.
Okay.
And I felt that it wasn't something that I could read about and then really truly understand.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is, because I only had two lectures in forensic pathology as a medical student, and both of them were given Saturday morning, in which I think I was the only student there.
Oh.
I mean, there were like 10 of us. And because not only was it Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, but we were specifically told it wasn't going to be on the exam anyway. And it was only those of us who were actually paying our own tuition who realized the value of every lecture.
Yeah.
So I realized that I needed. So I actually took a graduate course in forensic pathology, and then I worked at the morgue in Miami for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And
that must be a busy place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was horrendous. I mean, there's no way I wanted to be a forensic pathologist.
Yeah.
And everything that happened just underscored that. And yet, at the same time, I was fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
But then the benefit is that when I wrote a few autopsy scenes, they're very realistic.
Sure.
It's not, you know, just like, oh, I read about it or I saw it in a movie or something like that.
Now, as time went by, did you feel that you needed to go back into the autopsy suite and have another look, or are you able to kind of draw on that experience?
Oh, I drew on that experience.
Yeah.
Because it's not, autopsies are not the same as operations.
Right.
I remember when I did one novel which involved a cardiac surgeon, I felt that my experience with cardiac surgery had been very limited as, and so I called up a friend who was head of cardiac surgery in St. Louis, and I told him that I needed to come in and watch him do a couple of modern procedures. And he said, calm down, you know. Next thing I knew, he's got me all scrubbed up. I'm in there helping.
Yeah.
And so that I have that benefit of being able to call up friends and or not, sometimes not even friends. I remember when I was going to write Outbreak, and I was very interested in the CDC, and I was very interested in the containment, the level 3 containment. And I talked to someone in Naples where I was living, talked to a laboratory guy who ran the laboratory there, and I knew that he had been at the CDC for his, in lieu of his military. And I told him, I said, you know, I'd like to go up and see the maximum containment. And he said, I was there for 2 years. I couldn't get close to it.
Oh, wow.
So you're not going to... Well, undaunted, I got on a plane to Atlanta, and I flew, and I just took a taxi to the CDC, and I got out, and I walked in. And I had read a number of articles written by this one doctor who was doing a virus, and particularly the kind of virus I was interested in the hemorrhagic fever. And I called him up, and I'm sitting downstairs, and we started having this conversation. I told him who I was and why I was going, et cetera, et cetera. And in the middle of the conversation, suddenly he said, wait a second, where are you? And I said, well, it turns out that I'm downstairs. Oh, for goodness sake. And, you know, about a half an hour later, I'm in a maximum containment suit and going into the maximum containment.
Wow. That's excellent.
Yeah, he took me in. He showed me this. He showed me that. I realized, you know, how, so that when I described it in the book, it was a little bit more than just, you know, the usual thing.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. I suspect we're getting low on time. I don't want to take up more time than is mine. I have one last real quick question for you. I wonder if you have any tips for writers who are working on projects and they're writing villains and heroes. Do you have any tips about writing villains and heroes that are more believable characters or something you've learned in your career?
What I've recognized or what I've learned, I think, is that it's best to make them all human. Both. You know, if you make the bad guy too bad or... going to be less believable, and if you make the good guy too good,
right?
It's best to make them kind of believable, and it comes to mind. For instance, I wrote a book called Vector, and the
yes.
bad guy in that book is he's a Russian immigrant who is dissatisfied in the sense that he came with great effort to the United States and expected to be recognized and open-armed and et cetera, and that he was, you know, once he got in here, it was good. And he's stuck driving a cab, and he can't get out of the cab. And so he's really disillusioned, and that's the character. But, you know, he had a very different attitude and about races and a lot less, you know, he... Like a lot of Europeans, they can't understand how Americans are still racist.
Yeah.
And and he actually marries a black woman and stuff like that. But that, you know, coming to America wasn't exactly what he expected, and marrying a black woman wasn't exactly what he expected. You know, it's just a very sort of human kind of circumstance.
Right. So you humanize him, and he becomes real to us as we read about him.
Yeah.
And
he's doing, you know, crazy stuff. He's decided that to get back at America, he's going to unleash this bioweapon.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So that's my...
That's great. And I really appreciate your speaking with me today. The book is Nano, published by Putnam, and best of luck with it.
Well, thank you, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robin Cook. It was a shorter conversation than usual because he was giving, you know, something like 12 interviews in a row on the phone that morning. I thought he was incredibly energetic and interesting, considering that he was doing all those interviews all in a row. Anyway, you can learn more about Robin Cook's work on his website, robincookmd.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about something that is small, literally, but large in another sense. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Once you get to theradiator.org, you have to click to listen to the live stream, just so you know when you get there. You have to look for that. Archived episodes of the show are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show, if you have news about book-related events, you want to share a writing prompt, or if you'd like to suggest an author that I try to get in touch with and interview, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.